Thank you, and thank you everybody for coming. I thought I would focus this talk today on positive ways that scientists and journalists can work together to educate and inform people and share some of the insights and excitement that come from your work. And so I thought I would bring up some examples of science stories that got a lot of publicity and discuss what the scientists did to get so much attention and whether they had to do anything to compromise their integrity in the process. And I also want to talk about ways that I think you can help promote a genuine understanding of science, even in a media atmosphere that can be dominated by superficiality and hype.
And you welcome interruptions.
Yes, and I welcome interruptions. I think that works really well. I like the way
the picture is this.
I don't know. I just found that. Yes, that I just thought that would be a good illustration of selling your soul. So in thinking about this talk, I started to contemplate, you know, what scientists and journalists have in common. I thought maybe a good place to start thinking about working together would be to think about where we have common ground. And I came up with a couple of ideas. I thought, well, you know, we both really have some common values. We value reason and evidence over the power of authority. And I think we're both often driven by curiosity. And also, I think both professions try to employ techniques that help us to portray the world as it really is, as opposed to the way we want to see it or the way that the government or the church or other people want us to see it. And we also, I think, have some common ethical rules. I mean, plagiarism is bad in both fields, and there are a lot of rules about how you cite or quote other people. And also, making up data is really the other big no-no, which for you means measurements or observations, and for us means observations or quotes. So for the benefit of those who aren't at my first talk, I thought I would just give the sort of 45-second introduction to what I do and where I come from. I'm a professional journalist. I specialize in science, and I've written for a number of different publications, The Economist, Science News, New Scientist, and Science, where I was a staff writer for the news section writing about physics, and later I worked as a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is the main newspaper that serves the Philadelphia region. And while I was there, I covered news about science. I also wrote two weekly columns. The first one was called Carnal Knowledge and was about sex, believe it or not. And I thought that actually might make the topic for my third lecture while I'm here. The second one was called Planet of the Apes, and it was about evolution. And as you can see from this slide, one of the great things about being a science writer is it's one of the few professions where you actually don't spend most of your time sitting in front of a computer. I would guess I spend less than a third of my time actually sitting in front of the computer trying to get words to come out of my head, and most of my time really doing research, which sometimes means talking to people, and sometimes it means going out in the field and experiencing things. Here I am. Floating weightless in a NASA astronaut training plane. This is actually a scene from my most recent science adventure. This is actually in Haiti, believe it or not. I'm with a team of biologists, and they dropped us off in a piece of forest that's one of about 1% of the remaining forest in Haiti. And part of the mission there is to collect samples of some of the plants and animals and freeze them, because that in 10 years, that's really all that's going to be left of some of these things. So these are the kinds of experiences that really can shape your perspective on life and humanity's role on this planet. So currently I'm really a freelance writer, and though I have a couple of steady gigs, and one of them is with this website. This is NewsWorks, which is a website associated with WHYY Public Radio in Philadelphia, and it's becoming a competitor to the Philadelphia Inquirer as everything moves toward the web. This is Lightning Rod. This is the science blog that I write. It's sort of a hybrid between a newspaper column and a blog. So enough about me. Let's talk about some of these big stories that got so much publicity. The This is probably the story that I'd say got more fanfare than anything else in 2012 by far, and that is the finding of the Higgs boson. And I know that there was they got a certain amount of publicity because of the reference to the God particle. And in fact, the executive editor at the Inquirer, where I worked at the time, told me that he wasn't really interested in the story until he heard that it was the God particle, and then he thought it was intriguing. But I honestly think that there was a lot of excitement surrounding this, and it would have gotten a lot of attention even if that little bit of marketing had never been invented. And part of the reason for that was the way that the physicists presented this finding, which was very interesting. They made it really sort of come out as a big piece of news and a discovery, even though if you talk to the physicists, they say, well, there's no actual thing. You can't really see the Higgs particle. You know, it instantly decays into other particles that leave tracks in the detector, and there's not even a smoking gun kind of set of tracks that must be the signature of the Higgs. Instead, almost anything that could be the Higgs or anything that could be the Higgs could also be left by events that have nothing to do with the Higgs. So the way you find a Higgs is to gather a lot of data and then make a statistical argument. And that's all great, but it doesn't really lend itself to kind of drama that gets you on the front page of the newspaper. So how did the scientists deal with that? Well, I think they really did a good job of building up suspense. In this case, they sent out one press release in, I think it was December of 2011, announcing that they sort of had the Higgs, but that they weren't going to quite go all the way out on a limb and announce it. And you might think, well, that would sort of take the wind out of their sails. But actually, for people that cover lots of different fields of science, it got it kind of in our consciousness and on the radar screen. And so I think it primed reporters for what happened the following June when we got another press release that said they're going to announce something really big on the 4th of July. And by then, I think a lot of us realized that, well, if they announced the Higgs, that's great. And if they announced they ruled out the Higgs, that would be pretty exciting, too. So they had our attention. And then when they did make their big announcement on the 4th of July, it made front page headlines all over the world.
Do you think it would have been different if they hadn't had this fiasco or the speed of light?
I'm going to get to that. That's interesting, because I don't think they really... Because I was going to bring that up as a further down the road. I didn't want to start with that story. I thought I would start with one that turned out to be real. I think that's as far as we know, anyway. But I am going to deal with that. I don't think those are related exactly, except, well, we'll get to that. But I think that there were a couple of positive things about the way this was presented. One, it kind of plays into the way that people in broadcast and daily media think. I mean, that they give priority to things that you can say happened that day or yesterday. And so even though nobody actually grabbed a Higgs particle the day before, it was an announcement, it sort of brought everybody together and made it feel like there was a real event. The downside is that reporters are competitive and news organizations are competitive, and so nobody is going to say to their boss, look, you know, this is too complicated, I need an extra day. Like, that's not going to happen. Everybody is going to have it out the next day, complicated as it is. And so I think that can lead to reporting that either has errors or, in some cases, is kind of superficial. And the thing that I didn't like about some of the stories that came out about the Higgs was they just kept things too much in the scientist's language. And so the message that I think the public got was, well, this is interesting, but it's just over my head. It's too hard. I can't understand this. And I don't think that's really the message that you want to give people.
Uh-huh. Do you think that that's another reason for somebody like CERN to give the reporters, you know, 6 months to sort of like, you know, figure it out? I mean, it seems like, sure, they might have had one day, you know, from the press release to having to write a story, but they had 6 months to sort of prepare for one of two storylines.
Yeah, that's true, and a lot of us did. Those of us who cover science exclusively, I think, kind of knew, and I think the guy that covered it for the New York Times knew, and I knew. So lots of people were ready, but then it was also covered by a lot of news organizations that don't really follow science that closely, and so those people are covering all kinds of other things. things, you know, politics and business. And so, you know, we kind of jump from story to story, and there isn't a lot of in-between time. So I think you still see people like scrambling and rushing around when something's announced. And also with the web, it's not even, I mean, I used to think it was a tight deadline to write for a daily paper because something would be announced, you know, at a press conference the day before, and you'd still have that afternoon to call a couple people and, you know, get some perspective. And now it's like they want something on the web like in 5 minutes, which is a little scary. I try to resist that, but then there's time wasted like fighting with editors and explaining why you don't really want to do that. So for the biology people here, I thought I'd bring an example from that field. This goes back a little further, but I thought that this story was interesting because it was played in kind of a similar way in that there was no sort of moment of eureka moment with the Genome Project. And from what I understand, even when the announcement was finished, there were still sort of details and missing pieces and things people were working on. So there was kind of a decision on the part of the collaborations to come together and announce that they were finished. And so there was a certain amount of manufactured excitement here. They actually sent a press release out about a year early, saying they had, I don't remember exactly what they said they'd achieved. It was some kind of milestone, like a draft sequence or something. And so that also got it on people's radar screens and reminded people, oh yeah, they've been working on this genome thing for a long time. Maybe we should start thinking about that. And then they got some press on that. And then a year later, they came out saying they were finished, and they got lots of publicity. Here you can see the cover of Time magazine. The downside is, you know, this is a little misleading, cracking the code. I mean, they didn't exactly figure out what how the genetic code works. That had already been done. It was more like reading 3 billion letters of code. So, you know, this kind of makes it sound like, you know, the Enigma code or something. And there was also, again, kind of a mad scramble, I think, on the part of news organizations to make something coherent out of this. And there wasn't much time for people to question some of the claims that came out. And in this case, you know, I think with the physicists, there was a lot of genuine excitement. Here, there was, I think, a pressure on the part of the scientists to make it sound like this was going to be immediately useful. So there was this long list of diseases. You know, the Genome Project is going to lead to cures for cancer and Alzheimer's disease and autism and schizophrenia. And the list kind of went on. And people tended to repeat that. I think probably a fairer way to say it was that the Genome Project was a tool that might be useful for scientists that were studying some of these things.
This is an example of what, not studying
itself? Well, this, I think, you know, I want to sort of back up now and say, you know, I think that creating a sort of a, I'll go to the next slide here. This is a book that I read a long time ago. I thought it was really interesting. It's by Daniel Borstein. It's called The Image, and it's about the way that the media work. And he uses a term, pseudo-event, and pseudo-events refer to press conferences and ceremonies and all kinds of things that people do to try to get attention and then turn it into a sort of a media event. And you know, so when these stories come out, I think about pseudo-events, and I think in the case of the Higgs boson, I think that it actually, that they didn't sell their souls, except for the God particle thing. But the rest of it was okay, because I think it was channeling the genuine excitement that people were feeling in the field and trying to help people share in that. I think with the genome, the you know, all of the disease promises, that's starting to veer into more misleading territory.
But you're not, you know, both of the examples you've shown are cases where they're the results, the discoveries, the culmination of the project were two groups.
Yes.
And the decision to make the announcement and to arrange it, present it, and how it would be presented was effectively a political decision on the part of CERN on the one hand and the U.S. government.
Yeah, I think that's really important
so
point.
These were not just, these aren't typical events. These are massive, big science
yes.
events where politicians and or administrators of big labs essentially are in control.
Well,
very atypical.
Yeah, and I guess I would actually wonder whether it seemed like the scientists must have had a lot of input on the Higgs because they were able to sort of coordinate at a time when they
there was a whole political story about what, you know,
two collaborations, and, which was never reported.
Well, that might be one for me to come back on, then. It would be pretty interesting.
What was well known, but,
Can you go back a slide? Go back.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of richness to this. First of all, these two guys hated each other.
Oh, yeah, yes. This is...
They spent years knocking each other in the press, with Francis Collins having the Los Angeles Times in his pocket, and Craig Venta having several other organizations in their pocket. So they both had public relations teams killing each other. One was for profit, one was government money and foundation money. One was giving away the data free, one was selling the data.
Mm-hmm.
And it was out of that chaos that Clinton decided to stop this. And he got what's his name from England at the time, his favorite prime minister, and Tony Blair. He and Tony Blair got on the TV and announced that the project had been completed when it wasn't, right? It was about 85% complete, but in outline. And it was quite a mess, and almost the whole community sort of rallied around it to try to save it. I mean, it was a really interesting, rich story of competition in science and a lot of other kinds of aspects.
Yeah, and I think there were some books that came out that got into that.
And both of these guys don't have any souls to sell.
But he's actually, if you're a reporter, he's mean to all reporters. He's nice to all reporters.
You should point out we're recording.
And he doesn't. He also wrote a book where he didn't really believe in evolution.
Well, who? Francis Collins? Oh, yeah. Well, that's because he's his new. He's religious and he's kind of in that gray zone. He's not quite an intelligent design person, but a lot of what he says, that's a whole other discussion. But in fact, I could make my last talk about religion and science too, which is another thing I was thinking about talking about.
Maybe one of the questions is why did the media go with this fairy tales as opposed to the real tale?
Well, I think that,
subsequent books about these things.
Right. There are books. I think that the best, because of the competition, again, because everybody sort of, there's this press conference and you have to come up with something. And then the best you can do is say, well, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. It's sort of the trick to covering it is not to try to guess what is really there, but just say they're making this announcement and give the background, what this project is supposed to be about, that there are these two different people and one of them is privately funded. And one of them is publicly funded. So I think that the best stories are the ones that step back, and probably the best coverage is going to come out in books. But I wrote about this. I don't think that what I wrote was fairy tale. It was just covering what I did know about the announcement.
I just called it fairy tale to kind of be provocative. I mean, because the science is really interesting, and the science needs to be communicated. And as we talked about before, journalists often have this instinct to go for the blood-stained, butter and knife and the drama and stuff. And you can overdo that very often in news and science. So I'm wondering, in relation to these two examples that you're showing, where the media, as it were, and where scientists either did something right or failed to do something that should have been done, or what the real structure of what was going on was.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, there probably is no single story that really covers it. It is a book, It's just, there's a lot of complication and financial ties and intrigue and personality issues that come through here. But I think that at the same time that the public has a right to know, there was a lot of public money spent on the genome. And so I think people, that the press has an obligation to try to learn what we can about what they actually set out to do, how much of it they achieved, and, check into some of the speculation on why it might be medically useful.
Then there's limitations, because in a book you can go into all this interesting detail. On a web blog or a TV show, obviously you're not going to. So but what's going to get the most play?
But you look at, from the point of view of the general readers, they don't know what a genome is. They don't know what the Genome Project is. They don't know what any of this is. They just know that $3 billion were spent on it, government money, and they have a right to know at least as much as I can dig up about what this is all about.
So then why do we call it the God particle?
I tried to avoid that. In fact, I only wrote about the God particle to make fun of the people who use the term God particle.
Yes. You're really dedicated, but a lot of people are just like, oh, the God particle, okay, let's throw that onto the airwaves.
Yeah, well...
because people don't know what...
Yeah, it's confusing. It should never have that, you know... I thought that would die out. It actually, it's really old. I think Leon Letterman's book used that as a title in 1993, and you think it would have... people would have gotten tired of it by now.
I've got a question, because it's something that happens, as you pointed out repeatedly, in cases like global warming, which is, why didn't somebody write the obvious headline, which is, $3 billion wasted collecting useless information? It's the scientific fact of the genome.
Well, I'll let you finish.
So why not take that line? I would say that would differentiate you much better from the mass and would get you a lot more attention.
Pretty hard to defend that, though.
Actually, I'll tell you what I actually did do. First of all, you know, this is sort of similar to the arsenic bacteria story in that I knew right away that this was hype, and I actually didn't write about it the very first day because I feel like when you want to debunk something, you really do need to take a little time to make sure that you know what you're saying when you say somebody is full of it. And
there are thousands of kids who've had their metabolic diseases diagnosed because of the Genome Project. There is a whole area of cancer biology that relies on the Genome Project for drug development.
Right, it's been useful.
It isn't
that's a side discussion. But I think, yeah, that's a side discussion, though. I think that the approach here is, you can't just debunk something out of hand. But I did write a story about a week later that put some of the promises in perspective and talked about how, well, this is a tool that people will use, and they can't really promise that it's going to lead to these cures, but that a lot of scientists think it will be useful.
If one is going to complain about the media, especially the examples you gave, are examples where you could just get all the information from these big organizations that are justifying what they spent billions on, and it's clear. I mean, I think they're both obviously justified. But there are many cases where you actually have to go out and get the information. So I can even think of examples in science, of big science that has cost $500 million and has produced very little. I won't name the example. And in fact, there were no big press conferences announcing the results of some of those experiments. They, in fact, were big failures. This is something that is never reported.
We should talk after. I should come by and talk to you about this. Because part of the reason I'm here is to look for things that aren't.
Lacking often is what I would call investigative reporting.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to do. And in science, some of these things are experiments, and the question is, are they.
I'll give you an example to get the biologists rattled. There are investigative reporting at this point in time would be extremely useful. Before the money is spent, to investigate the European project to spend €1 billion a simulation of the brain, and then the American project is going to outdo the stupidity of the European project by spending $3 billion on a complete mapping of somebody's brain. Now, there is a project, where both countries, for whatever reasons, interesting speculation can be made by, I'm sure, people in this room, has latched on to spending, in our total times, billions of dollars and euros on a project which, at least my friends, confirm my suspicion that it's totally crazy.
Well, I think that is a good one, and that the time to talk about those is early. It's science. Sometimes the experiments don't go the way you want, so everything, right?
This hasn't been done yet, but it's before the public. So they're going to spend $3 billion of our dollars on a project which has not been really aired in the scientific community. And the press is, its responsibility is not just to come after the fact and after the disaster, but
nor is it to take all of its cues from the organizations that are promoting it.
Well, that's true.
It happens all the time. It's happening.
Well, and that's because of the way that people were sort of rushing to get a story in the press. But there were a lot of other skeptical stories in there and discussions with scientists about what the genome could and couldn't do. And I think, the stories about this brain project that will be useful will be ones where people spend a lot of time and do some legwork and talk to a lot of people about why they think it will or won't be useful and what it would or wouldn't accomplish, and that way that the readers and the taxpayers can get enough information to make good choices and should be able to decide for themselves whether they think that it's useful. I mean, there's a certain amount of arbitrariness. Some people think that sending humans to Mars is a great idea, and other people say that's expensive and it won't be scientifically fruitful, and we could discuss that all day. So there are, there's certain subjectivity in what people find interesting and useful.
But the same thing about sending people to the moon.
Yes.
It's also a lot of politics, though, too. I mean, I think people have known for a long time that mammography was an ineffective tool for preventing cancer. But try to get somebody to publish that until very, very recently.
Yeah, well, people wanted to see, they had some studies that were pretty definitive, and that was enough, I mean, you sort of need something to go with.
No, I mean, reporters don't want to go up against the established powers very often, because you've got a tremendous amount of pharmaceutical and nonprofit lobbying and industry united around saying that mammography saves X number of lives, which was basically was a lie. And they knew it. But nobody wanted to attack it because it was really unpopular.
I think that we do want to, we want to be on the right side, and if we think that everybody else is, that there's something that people don't know that's really important, I think I want to jump on it. It's just that I don't want to be wrong, so I want to be careful. You don't want to be wrong when you're going on a limb saying something that people say saves lives doesn't. You want to make sure that you actually know what the heck you're talking about.
There's plenty of reporters that actually, and scientists that they were their sources that knew this, Sean Carroll, for instance, I was trying to write this 10, 15 years ago. And you can't get published for certain types of things. You can get published for public relations generated, fluff. But try to get published for something that really knocks the socks off of a scientific enterprise. It's a different matter.
That is true. It can be, especially if you're a freelance writer, as I have been for the last only 3 months, and we'll start to learn how much harder it is to sell ideas like that that are new and different. And editors, of course, are reluctant partly because they don't want to be wrong. I think we're all.
I'm actually more cynical about it. I think that they don't want to go up against the people that are buying the ads.
That may be. I don't think so, though. I think, the Inquirer, one of the things that made the Inquirer a great paper when I first joined was that they were good at investigative reporting, and they did go out on a limb. They didn't care who advertised, but that changed, and by the last 5 or 6 years I worked for them, it was a totally different paper than the paper I had joined, and I think that that's true about with big regional newspapers across the board. So we're in a time of real transition in the world of journalism. So let's see. Oh, and I was just going to, as an aside, say that I think that, news stories, when I look at sort of science writing as a reader, and I've been a reader of science writing longer than I've been a writer, that really what, newspapers, the headlines, they end up, in the bottom of the bird cage. And what really matters is what people end up with in their heads. And they really, news stories, I think, are, even though they get big headlines, are the least memorable of the types of science writing that I've read. I mean, what I end up remembering are big feature stories in books. And I still think some of the best writing that I've read to date on physics was probably in Gary Taub's book, Nobel Dreams, which I thought captured some of that politics. This was a sort of a different particle hunt, but I thought he did a really nice job. He should have done the same kind of book for the Higgs, but he caught the sort of intellectual challenge of finding, in that case it was the W and Z bosons, and he captured the technical challenges, and he captured the political and social challenges of having these different competitive groups and having to sort of figure out how to not kill each other over this. And I think one of the best, some of the best writing on cosmology that I've read is still Dennis Overby's writing in Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos, which also caught the kind of the intellectual challenges of understanding the universe and also sort of social and political issues involved. And I think is better than the writing he does for the New York Times, partly because he was able to really step back and I think get the big picture. And that's really sort of where I want to go next in my career, because I think newspaper writing is confining and limiting, and that at some point you have to step out of that and think about writing books. So let's see. What do I have next? Okay, I promised one of the biologists at the multi-cell group that I would talk about this. I don't know, some of the physicists might want to forget that this thing ever happened, but it was interesting. I think there's it's worth discussing because I think there's sort of a teachable moment involved with this story. This was something that happened in the fall of 2011. It was out of CERN. It was an experiment. Pretty cool. It involved sending a beam of neutrinos more than 500 miles through the ground.
To Italy,
yes. So across a border, even. And I mean, that alone is actually kind of amazing to most people. They're just like, what? That's amazing. You can send this beam of neutrinos, and most of them go right through the detector, but you catch a few. So, you know, it actually would have been kind of an interesting story just to write about the experiment itself. But the people doing the experiment thought that they had detected that the neutrinos were actually arriving about 60 nanoseconds ahead of where they should have been if they were going the speed of light. So that's a pretty shocking finding, and I think the reason this story got a lot of press was that it would be a big deal if it were true, because it would violate Einstein's relativity. So there are really, there are really two obvious interpretations of what's going on here. This is the New York Times story on it. One, that Einstein's relativity will have to be rethought or modified because these neutrinos really went faster than the speed of light. And the other explanation, that the experimentalists made a mistake, did something wrong. And of course, one of these explanations is a lot more likely than the other, and one of them is a lot more exciting than the other. And so, not too surprisingly, a lot of the press kind of pushed the more exciting possibility. I thought I'd read a little piece of, this was a columnist, Charles Krauthammer, actually picked up on this story. And here's what he said about it. He said, the world as we know it is on the brink of disintegration, on the verge of dissolution. No, I'm not talking about the collapse of the euro or international finance, the Western economies, of the democratic future, and then he goes on and gets kind of wordy. He says, I'm talking about something far more important, which is why it only made the back pages of your newspaper. Though it actually made the front pages of some newspapers, if it made it at all. Scientists at CERN have announced the discovery of a particle that can travel faster than light. So anyway, you might think it's obvious why it's much more likely that these experimentalists made a mistake than that Einstein somehow made a mistake in formulating relativity. But to the general reader, that's not obvious at all. And I think that's why this is sort of a nice teachable moment, because it actually gives gives you an opportunity to explain to the public why it is much, much more likely that the experimentalists made a mistake. I remember when this story first broke, and I was talking to a theoretical physicist about it, and he said, well, it's definitely wrong because it's not theoretically justified. And I knew what he was saying, and you know what he's saying, but to the general public, this is sounds really weird, because they're thinking, I mean, first of all, the word theory is confuses people. You know, that, the biologists deal with that all the time, but people still, because we use it in sort of common speech as speculation, as this idea, and so people think, well, any theory of, I mean, experiments are real, that's data, that's real, and theories are ideas, so, you know, if the data says one thing, then the theories have to give way, and so I think there's an opportunity for you to step up and explain why that's not, probably not the case, and that Einstein's theory is backed by a lot of experimental evidence and a lot of observations, and that it's a lot more likely that, and that this experiment was, you know, it was a pretty difficult experiment to get right, and a lot of things that could have gone wrong, and eventually they did figure out, I think they did figure out what they did wrong, and it went away, and...
They figured it. Not only, I mean, this was a bad mistake. This is a trivial mistake.
Oh, okay.
We had a cable that was just not screwed in all the way, you know, with it. So that was not the kind of, I mean, sometimes experiments go wrong and they're subtle, even important people will learn, but, you know, we'll learn something from you.
Right.
In this case, we'll learn that somebody will simply pick it up. But, you know, the interesting thing in this example, which I'm not sure the stories you find the report of that ending, I mean, this was a great example of science at work. The experiment was repeated,
with the cable still loose, so.
No, a different experiment.
Oh!
At using the same beam, the CERN beam. This experiment, by the way, was an Italian experiment in Gran Sasso, not a CERN experiment. The only involvement was CERN. CERN supplied the neutrinos, but. Mm-hmm.
And it was announced there.
And so they redid the experiment independently and found the opposite result, which is one thing you should do. And number two, when the experimenters, who hadn't yet submitted a paper, was in the process of being refereed, hadn't published it, found the error, the collaboration, again, this is big science, 400 people fired the leaders. So the scientists who led this group actually paid for their error. Something which doesn't happen often, unfortunately, in science.
But there is also another aspect that this was not hype in the sense that the scientists did claim that their measurement showed higher than light speed. And this was very.
They did, but the physics community didn't think they were right.
Didn't misunderstand it.
Yes.
It was very clearly the statement by part of the scientists, and this was, you know, a collaboration with CERN, so it was, you know, high authority. And I mean, what David said is all fine, but I don't see that the press made a big mistake here. The mistake was just the scientist's mistake.
I think in this case, though, if you talk to enough physicists outside of this group, you get the, you know, you do get the impression pretty fast, or I did as a reporter, that it was much more likely that this was a mistake than that it was correct, and that
sure.
It still had to be, you know.
I mean, obviously, but.
That's true. Yeah.
Physicists knew it was wrong.
Yes.
We knew it was wrong.
You knew it was wrong, right.
For many reasons. Some because, you know, there was no evidence. Nobody had any good idea of what you would do if it was correct. And besides which, there were many experiments that directly measured the speed of neutrinos in other ways.
Yes.
Like
from the sun.
Solar.
Yeah, or the supernova, right.
And
they went a lot
predicted this by a factor of a million.
Yeah.
So it was clear. Everyone was, you know, on high ground for him.
Yeah.
That it was wrong. The big story there was CERN, again, CERN politics. CERN, the normal thing would have been that the Gran Sasso people would have announced the result at Gran Sasso. It would have been a press conference, but not at CERN, Gran Sasso. They wanted to announce it at CERN because it's has a bigger voice. And there was a fight over that. And the top administration said, we will hold the conference at CERN. And many of the people at CERN were very upset by that.
I can imagine. Especially now.
Because they were putting themselves out on exactly this kind of lending,
yes.
lending authority. So there's an interesting story there. But, you know, it's a great teachable moment about the scientific method.
Yes, exactly. And the other thing that I thought, the way that people like Charles Krauthammer kind of distorted it, was that they played it like, if this is real, then Einstein is sort of discredited and he's going to be, you know.
I find it absolutely charming and wonderful that people care that much. So the general public really kind of,
yes, you got their attention.
What is that number? What does it tell you? It tells you that they understand, as they should, that physics has established certain things with such certainty that their overthrow or their negation would be world shattering.
Yes. Yes.
That doesn't happen in many scientific fields. Well, I was wrong. The weather tomorrow will be this.
Why would you publish something on Einstein and not on the second law? There are much more crackpots that announce that they broke in the second law. Almost completed about that.
Oh, you don't read about it, about the crackpots?
Well, who proved that Einstein was wrong all the time?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of us have files from crackpots. But I bet when CERN holds a big press conference, then you think, okay, this is more than crackpots. We should pay attention. Like, what are they actually trying to tell us? So, there are a lot of crackpots out there. There might be one that's right somewhere. It's hard to tell. But that's good that we're not, you know, covering every crazy announcement that somebody sends us.
But your article here is excellent.
Oh, that's not mine.
I know, but the one you're showing is excellent.
Oh, okay.
It says, if true, it would be very important, but it seems highly unlikely it's going to be important.
Yeah. I think that, that's, yes. Where does it say that? Oh, probably some experimental error.
Yeah, that's a pretty good article.
Yeah, no, I think it's fine.
It actually has a lot of physicists' sources.
Yeah, no, and as I said, I still think, I think that he's done some of the best writing about cosmology. His book was really, I still thought it was really memorable. So I shouldn't have, yes, that was probably the wrong caption to put there, but so forgive me for that, because I think that this article is fine.
Yeah, the teachable moment is a good example. I mean, he's done a good job
yeah.
of saying, hey, this is intriguing, but it's probably
and
actually, wrong.
Yeah, and the fact that it's not on the front page is probably reasonable also, as much as Krauthammer would think it belongs on the front page. I think this is probably where it belongs. It's in their science section on the inside somewhere.
What happened with Fox News? Did they report it?
Possibly. They report things. You know, they do a little bit of science reporting, not really investigative, you know, that if it either is sort of supports a conservative agenda or it's neutral, they'll go after it. They would. They will any chance they get report to Darwin as well.
Coming back to the CERN project, do you think that the general public is becoming aware of the fact that science is becoming more resource intensive, or resources are increasingly concentrated into? Well, some of these big projects appear just very recently, and it seems that more and more will appear, as you pointed out, the Brain Project and others. So is the general public aware of this transformation?
You mean toward big science in all these different fields?
Whatever you call it, I'm just trying to observe it.
Yeah, I guess, you know, big science is sort of the word I would use. It's interesting that, I mean, that there may be a trend across different fields toward concentrating resources in a few projects. I think that's been out there a little bit, though written about more in the pages of Science and Nature and the scientists than in the general press. But I have seen some, especially around the time of the Genome Project, that people that discussed this idea of sort of huge amounts of money going to these big efforts as opposed to funding more independent things in smaller science. And
do you think there's research about public opinion regarding this?
Well, I think it's hard to form an opinion on the whole trend generally, but I think that it's good to have more voices out there talking about why it might be dangerous to put all our money into a few.
I don't know whether it's dangerous or not, just what people think.
Yeah.
You say it's dangerous?
I don't know. I mean, if it starves more independent type people of funds, or it makes it impossible to get funding doing something that's off the beaten track, then it could be that the science needs diversity, and so if it's all going in, if all the money's going to the same thing, I think it's something that reporters would have an obligation to try to point out, because really...
It's a lot of Title I grants.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of what?
It's a lot of Title I grants, which is traditional funding in biology.
Even
more NSF grants. Thousands of NSF grants.
Do you have an example of a small science project that was important and successfully promoted or reported?
I'll have to think about that. Maybe I'll come up with something for my next talk on that.
Look, I mean, the discovery, what about measles?
Goes back a ways, but you know.
The discovery of oncogenes was done on an R01 grant. It was done for $100 million.
What was?
The discovery of oncogenes in viruses.
Oncogenes, okay, there's a good one.
Bishop and Vomitz won a Nobel Prize, $150,000 grant. Biology always worked in small units of money. It's just until things like the Genome Project came along where it got more like physics.
Yeah, but I think that...
By the way, this is the institute of theoretical physics. Theoretical physics is still completely small.
Yeah, practically free.
These two out of three physics Nobel Prizes were single investigator research. They weren't big projects.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those they get publicity, especially if they get a Nobel Prize. But otherwise, I mean, we're all of the time that we're not sort of sucked into these big stories, we're trying to look for interesting things. I was constantly at Penn and other institutions around, and Princeton and the Institute for Advanced Study, looking at what people were up to. And some of it's, you see individual stories as opposed to everybody covering the same thing, which is a result of...
Example of the small, wasn't that a case of a small science project where somebody got a Nobel Prize?
Oh, yeah.
Helioback, you mean, yeah.
Yeah,
that replaced the whole pharmaceutical industry. It was just antibiotics to treat the bacteria that caused stomach cancer, and instead of tongues and other kinds of things.
Yeah, so these guys and these doctors in Australia were just, off on their own and discovered that everybody had always been wrong about the cause of ulcers.
Well, that brings us back to something you said earlier, which is important, I think, which is as reporters, we don't want to be wrong. And if we're reporting a plane crash, that's pretty easy to get, figure out if that's right or wrong. But science is really different. Right? Can you talk some more about how you go about determining if your story is going to be correct or not?
Well, yeah, I think that you don't want to have to guess on whether something is correct. You want to give the uncertainty. You want to communicate the uncertainty of the scientists, the uncertainty of the community. If a couple of scientists say they've got neutrinos going faster than light, and everybody else says, well, it's unlikely, then you have to communicate that. It's not our obligation to guess which one is right. It's to communicate what's known and what isn't. And I think that's the same with claims related to medical breakthroughs, that that we have an obligation to reflect the uncertainty, even if it moves our story off of the front page and turns it into...
That's part of the problem. Like, when is uncertainty news and when is it not news? How does that...
The uncertainty is always part of the news with science. I mean, because it's science. It has to... It's not about guessing who's right. We don't know. And there are times when we're pretty sure. Like with the neutrinos, I think people were pretty sure that it was wrong. But I think that uncertainty was reflected. And sometimes you can have a false uncertainty. Like, there are people that try to drum up more uncertainty than is warranted with climate change. And, factions that try to say, oh, we really don't know what's going to happen with the climate. We have no idea. We have no idea whether carbon dioxide really does anything to the atmosphere. So there's also a certain amount of common sense in figuring out whether the uncertainty is genuine or whether it's being generated by somebody with an interest. Uh-huh.
Can you comment on what's happened with the autism vaccines? Like vaccines?
Oh, well, Well, that's, you know, that's a really interesting story, and I didn't cover that myself, though I have kind of watched it. And in that case, it was a scientist who came up with this result that vaccines cause autism, and it was a real paper, though it was later retracted. But, you know, it kind of, it, that shows that things can really spin out of control because people, it's a story that's obviously of huge interest and, you know, it changed. I mean, everybody suddenly was worried about vaccines causing autism. But the press definitely didn't make it up. And then it kind of developed its own momentum because of activist groups and celebrities like Jenny McCarthy sort of getting involved. And so those things can take a life of their own. And I think that those can actually spawn new forms of pseudoscience when something is, pseudoscience can start as real science. And then when, you know, the result is shown to be wrong, but people don't want to give it up. I mean, there are people who don't want to give up cold fusion too. So I think
the investigative reporter that unraveled that mold.
That unraveled the fact that it was wrong, you mean? Well, there were a lot of people that I think thought it was wrong or were concerned about it.
Well, unraveled it in such a way that it became indubitable, you know, and nobody debated anymore unless they were totally cracked.
Which they are. There are many people who...
I mean, it resulted in the retraction of the paper. An investigative journalist actually got the paper.
So that, which shows that there is a lot of value in that, that science writers like us can be useful when we actually get involved in, you know, question things as opposed to...
Skeptical. Yeah.
And are skeptical and aren't, like, caught up on these bandwagons of, you know, these manufactured stories. So I think that's a good example. Which investigative reporter are you referring to?
Andrew, he's a British guy. I can't remember his name. He's written a book now, too. But for years, he was going, no, this is not right. And he just doggedly went after it and just went beyond what reporters normally do and ended up blowing the thing out of the water.
So before we derail Faye's train anymore, maybe let her get to her destination, and then we'll save our
questions.
Okay,
I just have a couple more things. I'm actually pretty close to the end. I thought that just because this is sort of the science story of the week that and people were talking about over the weekend, that I would just sort of bring in a little section on this. And I, you know, this is obviously not a pseudo event. This is a real thing that came out of the sky and exploded over a populated area of Russia, got a lot of attention. And I thought, you know, what was interesting to me was the press releases that I was bombarded with over the next 3 or 4 days from various factions and groups saying that they thought it was this was an important warning and we should spend a lot of money deflecting asteroids. And so, you know, I was amazed at how many different people are in business to try to do this. And I was actually talking to a geophysicist over the weekend who had been interviewed in by a newspaper reporter and had also been on TV. And I said, well, don't you think that it would be important to explain to people that there are a lot more small bodies out there than big ones that could destroy the whole Earth, and, you know, that we're actually much more likely to be hit by relatively little ones like this than, you know, the kind that wiped out the dinosaurs. And he said, yeah, oh yeah, absolutely, because there are orders of magnitude more little ones than ones that are gonna destroy us. And I said, well, did you say that? And he said, no, because I just assumed everybody already knew it. And I think, you know, that's another example of something where there can be a disconnect between the way scientists think and, you know, what people in the general public think, because he probably could have helped people kind of put it in perspective if he had realized that that's actually not obvious, that most people don't really realize that. In fact, with all these sort of people trying to scare everybody, people think, oh, well, we're just lucky that this one was little. It could have just as easily been huge and wiped out, you know, half the world. So,
Well, it wasn't because it was on the same day, right?
So, yeah, it was on the same day as a flight. Yes.
The big one.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It was kind of a weird coincidence, you know, that there was
an issue which was not reported currently, right? Which is, what is, how big was this? Some people said it was 7,000 tons, and the Russians said it was 10 tons. And nobody picked up on
it. Yeah, because
how do you estimate the size?
Yes, and that's sort of an interesting follow-up story, because I think people are still arguing about that, because you have to sort of, it's kind of a detective story to figure out from the aftermath of it, since the rock didn't actually land, it exploded, so... That might be a really interesting science story to talk about how you figure out what this thing was. But you know I thought that it was very interesting that I think that there's sort of general misunderstandings in the public that PR people are very aware of, and so they you know they really exploit those right away. And this was just one of I just picked this at random as one of the flood of press releases I got. And you can see as I thought it was interesting the way that they use numbers here, and that they're saying that they're estimated to be more than 10,000 near-Earth asteroids that could destroy a major city, and 100 that would end civilization. Near-Earth asteroids are confirmed at a rate of more than 900 per year. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but as yet little is known about their composition or structure. And so this all, you know, it sounds really scary to a lot of people because near sounds like, you know, why would they call it near if it wasn't like kind of whizzing right by our heads? Though actually that term has a specific meaning in science that's not quite as near as most people think. And that number could be high, it could be low. It's sort of, you know, this, it really doesn't mean much without an explanation of how near these near things are and how likely they are to hit us. And so I actually asked my geophysicist friend about it, and he said, well, you know, actually, you might think from reading this that we're really lucky that we're here. And, you know, how unlikely is it that we could be here with all these space rocks flying over our heads ready to smash us to oblivion? But it's actually, the big ones don't come that often, and it's not that surprising that over the course of history, exactly zero cities have been destroyed by asteroids, but a lot of cities have been destroyed by earthquakes and hurricanes and floods and tsunamis and various kinds of bombs. And I think in a way also, to put it in perspective, if we don't do anything about this asteroid threat over the next couple of years, well, the result will probably be nothing. We'll probably be able to get away, you know. The chances are we won't be destroyed by an asteroid the next couple of hundred years. But if we don't do anything about the buildup of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, the chances are actually pretty good that we'll see some catastrophic consequences. So I think that, there are sort of smart ways to think about this and put it in perspective. Well, I'm just about wrapping up. I had a couple of kind of final ideas about this. One is that I think that I never really liked the term dumbing down, because I think it implies that using really simple, understandable language is bad in some way. I mean, if you look at the asteroid press release, would it be dumb for a reporter to take that scientific language and translate it into something that people could find useful and understandable about the relative risk of these things? Or would it be smart to just parrot the numbers that the press release gives and the language they give, which might give a different impression? And my conclusion is that in science, the reality really is much more interesting than the hype or the pseudoscience. And so that's kind of an advantage that we all have, that there is something really genuinely exciting going on in science. And I think that that's why we really can work together to promote a genuine understanding. And that it's, that the real picture can be more complicated and more difficult. There's a lot going on. You want to write about why the Higgs particle was really announced when it was. Well, there's a lot there, probably a whole book rather than a newspaper article. But I think getting all that information is worth the effort. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that most scientists would like to see science read as educated. That it's a conduit between the scientific community and the public that would give them enough education so they'd understand the value of science and be useful to science. However, I've heard many reporters say, and in fact reporters from the New York Times science team say, that they're there to entertain the public, not to educate the public. And their editors are forcing that concept of entertainment with balance. You always have to have a negative person who says that this isn't so important, and a positive person says it's very important and so forth, but education is not their goal. What do you think?
I think that's unfortunate. I mean, I think that you can be a good teacher and be interesting. You know, I mean, you have to be, you can't be boring and be a journalist. Your stories have to be interesting. But I think that, you know, the reality is interesting. It just takes more work to get there. So I don't think that that's an either-or situation where you have to be educational or you have to be entertaining. I think that if you're educational and you really get, capture the essence of what's exciting about science, then people will also maybe not be entertained. That sounds kind of superficial, but will be intrigued and enlightened. And so, it's unfortunate if they feel they're getting that pressure. I've fought with every editor I ever had. You know, I think that's part of being a reporter. And the more recent ones were the worst. But it doesn't mean you have to give in to that.
Yes. Well, just following that up, what do you think of like TV shows like Big Bang Theory? Is that being good or bad?
You know, I need to start watching that. I don't even have, you know, the little apartment that I'm staying doesn't have a TV, so I haven't actually watched TV since I got to Santa Barbara. But you know, some TV can be good, and I guess people like that show, so maybe it's positive. But I haven't watched it, so I can't directly. I mean, sometimes TV can give people kind of a distorted picture of things too. It's definitely it's not a substitute for reading. I guess I wouldn't be in the writing field if I thought it was.
Uh-huh. How much pressure is there on reporters to give maybe an artificial balance to stories?
No, I don't get any, but I think...
An antagonistic point of view when that might be an extreme minority.
Yeah, I don't get that pressure. I think that some publications may do that, but if they really, the editors don't trust their reporters, I think sometimes you might get that by mistake because you're just interviewing a sample of people and it's not the best sample of people you could interview, and so you get some naysayer when there's actually pretty good consensus, or the problem is, you especially when you're working on a deadline and you're sampling people and you might not get a representative sample. If you write about the same fields of science over and over, you do start to get an idea. I mean, I covered physics pretty much exclusively when I was at Science, and I had a pretty good idea of where the consensus was and who thought what and who said what. So if you have that picture, that mistake is less likely to happen. I think sometimes it is just a mistake that you get somebody, but there may be other people that get that pressure to present both sides of things where there isn't, especially like evolution or climate change.
I wanted to come back to the title of your talk. And I would still love it if the two of you perhaps would take a 4-hour afternoon and take those of us who are interested in the title of your talk, and you give us a little 4-hour course writing a press release.
Oh, okay.
And we could each pick some story that we were involved with or a story that we liked, was interested, maybe didn't get any press, and write a press release and then have you critique it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that it's something that is how you present a material that will intrigue somebody enough to notice it without overselling it. What things that if you're writing the press release to your press office, which is usually what's going to happen, how to make it intelligible without dumbing it down, without sensationalizing it, and yet also making it interesting.
Yeah, no, that's that would be fun. I mean, I would be happy to do something like that, and I think
we can discuss that. Yeah. With Lars and the two journalists.
Bart, to come back with to the issue, many of our visiting journalists have told us to get published, it has to be news. So you can't just take a topic. You have to take something that an editor can identify as timely and interesting.
Well,
that's pretty much an invariant.
That's true, but the great thing about science is so much of it is new to the general public. Sometimes the things that people find most exciting about a story are the things that we all knew 10 years ago, but they just, people are like, just like the idea of neutrinos. You know, people don't know what a neutrino is, or the idea that you could send it through the ground and pick it up on the other side. So there's actually a lot that you can work with just in the fact that a lot of this is new to people, and you do need to have some currency when you're working in the media, but it doesn't have to, it can be a trend, it can be, there are all kinds of things that without having it to be a sort of a pseudo event that you manufacture.
So
are you sure that the general public actually cares about science to the extent that you seem to suggest? For example, you could tell them neutrinos are passing through your body all the time, millions and millions of them, or dark matter is going through your body all the time. And that's this kind of sensational stuff that they would eat up. Whereas, and they want to know that this meteorite is destructive. I mean, nobody's interested in the details of how large it is, what is the real probability that a meteorite is, you know, how often have extinction events happened on the planet. Maybe that should have been covered. Dinosaurs died as a result of one of these, but that happened 60 million years ago.
That's a long time. Yeah. You know, but I think that's part of the challenge of my job is to present things in an interesting way. So I think that there are scientists I know that are going to Russia right now, and that there's going to be sort of a detective story to try to understand what happened. And I think that can be presented as an interesting story. So there's a challenge for me. And also, I think the general public is a diverse group. But I do know people that follow science the way people follow sports. They love it. And you know, there are a lot of people that really liked science in high school, including me, that just didn't go on to become professional scientists and still are really curious about what scientists are doing and what they're learning about the natural world.
Yes, so I guess I'm converging with the previous question here because I still don't get it, okay? In the sense that there are a lot of tips of what is bad journalism, bad communication, good communication, but this is not giving me indication on how I get your editor interested in publishing some good.
You have to get me interested, and then I'll find a way to get the editor interested.
So it starts. Our check will do it.
No, it really. You, I mean, it's really my. You know, my job is to convince the editors, and so you've already convinced me that it's interesting. I mean, we could talk about the you convince the reporter, and then the reporter has to convince the editor, and it's definitely doable because if there's something that's new to the. If it's new to the general public, if people don't know about it and it's exciting and some of the things you're working on are, then I think, and there is a trend, it doesn't have to be something that happened yesterday, then it can be fodder for a really interesting feature story for a lot of different publications.
Does every researcher have a set of science journalists on their speed dial?
Yeah, well, we have you on, actually it's good to be on our speed dial because we count on people to get, you know, when there is a news story breaking, one of the ways that I try to avoid falling into the trap of what they're telling us to say is to get on the speed dial and call the scientists I know and say, so what do you think? You know, what's going on here? What do you think about, did you see this genome announcement? And then they say, oh yeah, you know, and so you get perspective. So it's good to be on a reporter's speed dial because we count on you and it's not necessarily promoting your work, but it does a huge service for us to have scientists as sources to comment on other things.
Let's thank Jay and we can speak with her partner.